Buffalo gal, won't you come out tonight? Come out tonight, come out tonight. Buffalo gal, won't you come out tonight and dance by the light of the moon?
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and this is the second day of Fechter's Finger Flicking Frolic, and we just finished with Tim Ellis's lecture, and in this podcast today, we're going to be talking with different people who are here as registrants and performers, and a lot of them are one and the same. In this particular case, I have one of those with me, Chris Pillsworth.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Yeah, you got it right.
And what's the correct Canadian pronunciation of that?
It's the same.
The same.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Because you are from Canada, Toronto, or whereabouts?
Ottawa.
Ottawa.
Yeah.
Okay. And that I wanted to talk with you because that you're going to be performing tomorrow night on Friday night show, is it?
Friday afternoon show is okay. When I'm performing.
All right. And you performed last year, or was it the year before?
No, last year. Last year was my first year here.
Okay. And you came back again because
it's
just a great time, isn't
it? Yeah, I love it. I find this convention's nice and intimate, and you get to meet a lot of people and meet up with old friends.
And you're making a lot of new friends then as well, which will become old friends as years progress. And that's
absolutely
a great thing, I think, about this convention here, where that you really have
really
time to
I
spend
like.
Time.
Yes.
With folks.
Yeah, and it's not too big that it's overwhelming either.
Right. A lot of conventions are exactly that, like that, Chris, in which you're just saying hello, and then you're running on to somebody else, and you don't have time really to spend quality time, you know. But one thing last year, of course, that stood out in my mind, and most everybody else's who walked around said, you're the cactus guy.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, just so everyone knows exactly what that means, who haven't seen your act, because you performed not only here, but also you were at the Magi Fest.
Magi Fest this year as well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Explain the act.
The effect is that I have a cactus which is planted in a terracotta pot, and I also have a large clear balloon. And I managed to put the cactus in the pot inside the balloon.
Without the balloon popping.
Without the balloon popping.
Yeah. And I think it has, we just heard Tim Ellis's lecture, and it was about care, you know, about connecting to the audience and everything.
Exactly.
But I think you have a nice kind of a presentation with that, and you know, with the delicacy of the balloon and the prickliness of the cactus,
it
seems like. So.
And with a lot of the materials, sometimes what takes place is the trick comes first, and then it takes a while for a presentation to reveal itself. Presentation, like what Tim was saying, that resonates with an audience and makes them care. And I'd been doing that trick for quite some time, and knew that the presentation wasn't exactly what I wanted, but just determining that you need something better is step one, and then your mind works on it subconsciously perhaps and begins to sort out the problems with presentation until it becomes something that truly makes it great. And that's consistent with all the great magic that you see. You can present it so that it's just a trick, or you can present it so it's relevant and has more impact, but that takes time to sort those things out.
Yeah, and that's why it's going to go to the creative process as to something like this. I mean, the creative process is not only coming up with the trick itself, but the presentation in order to make it entertaining and not just necessarily a mystery, but something that people will care about and they want to see.
Yeah, for sure. So it's just a matter of trying to, I'll write down different ideas and concepts that could be used for the premise for a trick. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's trial and error. I think that's the same with most of the workers out there, that you test out something, you see how it's received by the audience, if a line gets a laugh or the line resonates with people, you keep it in. If it doesn't,
sure,
you try and fine-tune it, maybe over a few more performances, tweak it, change the line, until you get what you want. And the trick over time is just a matter of polishing it, and you're taking all those little moments and making them all count.
Mm-hmm.
And taking out everything that doesn't count, that's not supporting the success of the trick.
That's a good point.
Yeah, and retaining everything that does. And over time, the trick will expand, but it's like George Burns said when he was on Carson one time. Johnny said, how do you know when something's polished? And George says a routine is like a rock or a stone. It's kind of rough, and every time you have a rough part, you take a bit of sandpaper and you just sand it smooth. And he said, when you keep sanding all those little rough parts smooth, when you get to the point where there's no longer anything left to sand, that's when it's polished. And I like that quote too, because even for someone like George Burns, it let everyone else know that someone who was as great as he was still had to go through the process of polishing, and it wasn't something that you'd do overnight. It was something that was ongoing, and it would take you time. But the thing with something that's polished is when it's in your show, you feel so good about it, because you know you've put, like a craftsman, you've put a lot of work into it, and as a result, you derive the benefits from that because of all the work that you've put into it.
Well, that's true. It reminds me also then of an artist. I remember with Da Vinci about the sculpture that is within the rock. You're trying to get to it.
Yeah, you remove everything that's not the sculpture.
Exactly. And that was kind of what I was thinking when you were saying that. You're removing all these parts and everything, you know, so everything that's not the sculpture. Exactly.
Yeah. And you won't know what those parts are until you actually put it out in front of an audience.
Right.
So I feel that for myself with my tricks, when I get a trick first into the show, it's going to take maybe about 5 shows before I start feeling comfortable with the trick in the show. Then at that point, then it's time to start to edit and add and take out the parts that aren't working and put in parts that are working. And for my roster, my repertoire, the tricks that go in brand new are like babies, and they're going to need a lot of care,
nurturing,
and attention and nurturing to allow them to grow. When they're kids, they're a little bit more confident, they can walk on their own. When they're teenagers, they'll be getting better. And the tricks that become the ones that are your go-to tricks, that are the ones that you feel so comfortable with, they're like the grandparents. And they've been through everything, so it doesn't matter what situation you put them in, they'll be able to deal with it, and they'll be able to deliver time and time again.
Tried and true.
Yeah, exactly. And so in the show, obviously you want to have grandparents exclusively. That's your A material.
Right.
But you need to change. And as you get older, some tricks which may have been your A material beforehand no longer fit you where you are in your life. And so you have to graciously say goodbye to them and discover new babies that will subsequently become the grandparents over time.
Right. And develop with you as you develop then also.
Exactly.
You're not the same person necessarily.
Yeah.
You can't be that young person with that kind of presentation all the time. You have to, this isn't you, I don't think.
Yeah, and there's certain things that I can do now that I couldn't do when I was younger.
Likewise. Exactly. I was thinking of some people, like young people trying to do mentalism. You can, but it seems like that if, you know, you are a gray-haired, you know, wizened older man, that you can say, well, I've traveled to China and whatever. Well, you've got a 12-year-old, so, well, I've traveled to China and I've, you know, bring you these miracles or something. It doesn't have the same belief. It
doesn't ring true.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to be true to that. Well, going back to the creative process, that did you come up then? We're going to get to the one you're doing on the street and the turban here in a moment. But I wanted to ask you about the cactus as far as the presentation. Did you just come up with the idea? Did you see something? Or did you sit down and say, I'm going to be creative? Or did you wake up in the middle of the night and say, hey, here's an idea? Or how do these come to you?
I studied industrial design. And industrial design is product design. So that was a 4-year program at university, or what would be the equivalent of college in the States. And my parents wanted me to back up my magic with something, so if it didn't
get a real job.
Yeah, exactly. And I went and saw some of the graduation shows prior to going into the course, and it was a limited enrollment, so I put together a portfolio and got in. It's a very creative pursuit in the sense that you're designing products for mass production, whether it's furniture or lighting or automobile design, for example. And it also combines a strong sense of the artistic and also the nuts and bolts of putting something together, the engineered parts of the product works properly. So I've always had that sense of using my creativity in the magic. With the cactus, I'd seen I always liked Steve Martin, the comedian, and there was way back in the 80s, he had the cover on Esquire magazine, and the staff photographer took some photographs to go with the article, and they had about 3 or 4. One of the photographs had Steve Martin. He was holding a cactus in one hand in a terracotta pot and a red balloon in the other hand. Mm-hmm. And I looked at the photograph, and I thought, that was such a great photograph, because in one still photograph, there's conflict and tension and drama. There's a story.
The story in the picture.
Yeah. Exactly. And I always kept a book, like a lot of creative people, a book of ideas where things get written down. And so I put, wouldn't it be neat if I could put a cactus inside a balloon? And that was the start point.
I see.
And from there, it's a matter of breaking it down into all the little problems that add up to the solution. Like any magic trick, you have different components, and some you'll know what the solution is right away. Other ones, there's no precedent for something, and you have to start looking. So once your eyes are open to what the solution needs to be, then I remember I was at a shopping mall and I saw a kiosk, and there was something there that ended up being a component of the solution for the cactus. And so I started putting it together, and I thought originally it was going to be one way, but it wasn't working properly. And then I was at a festival, and I met another magician, and he said, well, you should go and do a competition. And that was NICAN in Albany. Mm-hmm. And that was 6 months away, and I thought, okay, this will be an excellent deadline to see if I can get my cactus trick working for that.
And what year was this?
That was like 1987 or maybe 88 back then. And it was great because I knew at that point that I couldn't be wasting any time. So I put together the version with cardboard boxes and the cacti, and that was the first time I presented it. So it was great. But even since then, it's gone through about 7 or 8 versions of the trick where I've remade components of it. Mm-hmm. And then, so that's from the nuts and bolts technical part of the trick, the creative approach to putting that together. And then presentation-wise, it's gone through about 3 or 4 totally different presentations to the one where I'm very happy with now. But you have to start somewhere. So the best thing to do is just practice, put it out there, what you've got, and then start to get a sense of how well it's received, where the weaknesses are, where the strengths are, and to edit.
Yeah.
From that point
start
on.
Start whittling like we were talking about
too. Yeah, exactly.
Well, we were at dinner last night, and we were talking about you working on the street. And is mm-hmm. that something that you performed on the street? Is that practical?
On the street, when I was at university, one summer I worked on the street busking in Ottawa. They have a pedestrian street, which is great for buskers. And I worked that one summer to earn tuition. And after I graduated, there wasn't really enough time to get really good at that. I needed to get money right away, so just regular shows was what I was doing. About 4 years ago, I've been in magic full-time now for 28 years, and when you've been doing it that long, you walk into most situations being able to size them up pretty quickly.
True.
To get a good sense of what's required for this situation, whether it's drunk adults or unruly kids or any of those variables that come into play. And I found that even though I still love magic, that I was losing a little bit of that spark. And when I'd seen busker festivals in my hometown of Ottawa, I was always envious of the buskers who were very good because they could take 300 or 400 people that were complete strangers and have them in the palm of their hand with whatever type of show they had, whether it was juggling or contortions or magic. I was envious, but I was also incredibly fearful of that situation because on the street when you're busking, the fear is that people will walk away from you and it hurts the ego. But I decided I'd like to give it a try because it was a new challenge. And what's happened as a result of that is that every moment when you're on the street busking needs to be compelling to keep the people who are watching there, and also compelling enough that people are just walking by. They don't walk in at the beginning, maybe partway through a
right.
trick. That will be enough to stop them, enough that they'll get into it and they'll stay. So
if it's too involved or too long, they're not going to understand and walk on.
There's certain tricks that I thought would be great that weren't. And conversely, there's certain tricks that I thought would be terrible that have turned out to be really good ones. And the turban trick is one of the ones that I wasn't convinced, but a friend of mine from Ottawa, Roy Cotty, who's been not exactly a mentor, but whenever I have questions about something that I'm researching, I always go to Roy first because he's been at it for so long and he'll always be able to steer me in the right direction. And he'd been doing a little bit of busking for fun. And he said the turban trick is a good one. So essentially the turban, for people that are unfamiliar with that, is cut and restored. Originally it was used with cheesecloth, and they'd have maybe about 5 or 6 yards long by whatever the width would be, two people holding the ends.
Maybe about a foot wide or something.
Yeah, something like that. It'd get cut in half and then tied into a knot. And then in the original version, you'd light the ends and you'd put the fire out, and then the knot would would all go back together again, one piece.
But the idea of a turban being that the fakir from the street could have it around his head, and he would unwrap the turban, and then...
Yeah, that's the original context. So even though the presentations have changed a bit and other magicians have done it not using the turban, it still retains the name from the original form. Mm-hmm. So I ended up giving it a try. I thought, I'll give it a try. And I would use material which would be 5 or 6 yards long, 15 inches wide, because I was using cotton, and it came in a 45-inch width, so I'd tear it into 3 strips, and I'd be able to, each time I'd maybe cut off 8 to 12 inches, so I'd be able to get maybe 5 or 6 performances with each length. So with 5 or 6 yards long, I'd be able to get maybe 15 to 18 shows with that, and maybe it was $20.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
I mean, it was a consumable, but it wasn't too expensive per show.
Right.
And I started doing it, and little by little, it started to evolve to the point where now it's one of my favorite tricks. I'll use it as my closer for my adult shows, and it's just turned into a really nice piece. And it's called The Fabric of Life. So it deals with things that, like we mentioned before, now that I'm 50, I can sell that with conviction, because I've had some ups and downs in my life. But it would have been terrible for an 18-year-old or a 20-year-old or a 22-year-old. You don't have enough
life experience.
Spins around the earth.
Yeah, there you go. But the title of that, of The Fabric of Life, you mentioned dinner about the how that came up, that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, so when you're just trying to discover how to present the trick, there's... You learn just by things working or not working. Originally, what I would do is I'd take the fabric and I'd wrap it around a dowel of wood, which would be 18 inches long, and I'd wrap it up like a toilet paper roll. And I don't do that anymore, but as I was unrolling it one day, I'd hand the ends to one person. And as I was unrolling, it just came out of my mouth. It just, like, improvised. I wasn't even thinking about it. I said, "This is the fabric of life," as I was unrolling it. And at that moment, because I write my own scripts, and after a while you get a sense of what will play well and what won't. And if you got a line or something that you just know, that's a keeper.
Yeah.
And when that came out, "This is the fabric of life," I thought, that's it. Now I've got the beginning, that will be the skeleton of what the script will be. And I know from there I'll be able to flesh it out. But I know that's the opening line.
Mm-hmm.
And then it just kind of developed with little bits and pieces that got integrated. A few things that I thought were good moments, but they were a bit too long. Like the joke didn't happen right away. I thought it needs to be 1, 2, 3.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out the other two weren't funny. So
okay.
I trimmed them out, and then I got the laugh.
You learned quickly.
Yeah. And so over about maybe 3 years or so, it's turned into a really nice piece.
You say you actually close your shows with it. I mean,
my adult shows, not my kid shows,
right,
but my adult shows.
Okay.
And because it talks about life experience, which is fantastic, because I think with magic, at the end of the show, you obviously want them to have seen the magic and thought, "Wow, that was fantastic, and I don't know how that's done." But I think ultimately, what I'm looking to do is I'm looking to communicate ideas and concepts and universal truths to people through the medium of magic.
Pretty heavy.
And at the end of that one, well, then some are light and some are a little bit more resonant. But at the end of the show, I want them to realize that even though we deceive when we're presenting things, that I don't want them to think that that was the central focus of what I'm doing. That I just love what I do, and I want them to enjoy the experience too. And if they walk away from that at the end thinking, "There was a guy who did great magic, but he was also a person and a human that I'd like to sit down and maybe have a drink with or a conversation with." And that to me is I feel that I have succeeded at that.
You've broken that fourth wall, and they become your friends and vice versa.
And the other thing that takes place too for individuals, most of us workers, is that if you're doing a show and you've been hired by one individual on behalf of an entire group, That means the group didn't necessarily come to see you, per se. Right. Like you would go see a concert where you want to see the person because you like them and you know it's going to be great. So they really haven't invested any of themselves into the performance. They haven't invested their money. They need to be there because maybe it's a corporate function and mm-hmm. they have to be present.
Right.
But maybe they don't like magic. And you have to break that down. We're not there to entertain just the people that like magic. You've been hired to entertain everyone.
Right. And maybe change some ideas.
Change some ideas. And so it's important to establish soon in the show that even if they perhaps don't like magic, that it's going to be an entertaining evening
right.
or show. And so at the end of it, if they walk away and they've had a good time and I've changed their impression of magic because it's been entertaining, it's been resonant for them, they've had some interesting moments, they've seen some cool things, they've had some laughs, mm-hmm. and we've had fun as a group, then mission accomplished, both for myself as a performer, for myself artistically, for the audience, because I haven't wasted their time, which to me is the ultimate currency. That's the one that's more important than money, because time you can never get back. And if you've done a show and you've wasted their time, they can't get that back, and that's going to mm-hmm. tick them off. That's why we need to be good craftspeople with what we're doing, so that we are not responsible for wasting other people's time. Because if the show is well received, everyone wins.
Right. That goes the same also for close-up. Here we are at a close-up convention, and I think the same thing when I walk up to a group of people, that I better be not just good but entertaining and also engaging, such that they may be talking about something serious and I'm interrupting their conversation to be a part of their sphere for a few moments. And what do I have to show them that's going to be important enough to make that kind of a major interruption in their life to pay attention to me, a total stranger, for a period of their life?
Yeah.
Is it a wasted time, or is it some time that they will remember? And so when they're on stage, I mean, as you said, a corporate function, people are already there, and it's like, oh, you know, it's a magician. But then they get a better idea once they realize, oh, this was a lot of fun,
yeah.
and they might change their perspective. But when you're doing some close-up and you're walking up, and you need to make sure, again, just as you were saying, that this is going to be something that they will remember and enjoy.
Yeah, and I've done table hopping, too, both at corporate functions and also in restaurants, too. And it always, the same thing always holds true, and everyone has to discover the way that it will work for them, because everyone is different. So you're basically trying to take the tools that you might discover at conventions in terms of tricks or ideas. Those are your tools. Mm-hmm. Now what you need to do is you need to take those tools and tailor them to you, so it's like the difference between a suit off the rack
right.
and getting one tailor-made. Now,
right.
not everyone can afford tailor-made. But if we're talking about time invested in our craft, then I think that's the responsibility of a person who's accepting money for what they're presenting. That's our end of the bargain. That's what we need to be responsible for. And in close up going up to the tables, there's different ways of doing it, and people have different ways of the introduction and what does that need to be, and it will vary depending on your personality type mm-hmm. and the type of people that you're working for. But if you discover it and it works well, then you're off and running. And it's that very sort of important first few seconds or minutes, depending on if the show is shorter or longer.
But you got a good point. I was just thinking when you mentioned tools about being a craftsman, you know, what type of a house are you building? Are you building a shack? Are you building a mansion? You know, what are you doing with those tools? We all have access to some of the same tools. A hammer may be a hammer, you know, regardless of how much you may spend for that hammer, but what are you going to build with it?
Yeah, and you know, there's nothing wrong with say, for example, a furniture comparison would be IKEA versus something that's more high-end.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you understand what the group is that you're performing
exactly.
for.
Not that it's wrong, one way or the other, whether it's a shack
or
IKEA or whatever. Right?
Yeah, like in the Second World War, the U.S. Navy was building ships. And the Italians were also building boats. Now, they both need to get up to speed pretty quickly, but the Italians mm-hmm. built the most, they built beautiful boats.
Okay, ornate.
And they weren't building them quickly. And the Americans were built them fast. They made them functional. They made them work the way what it needed to happen. They could crank them out more quickly, which is what was necessary.
Right.
So one could say, well, the Italian boat was a nicer boat, but for the purpose that it was designed for, the American boat was more successful in achieving its goal, because the goal was defined in terms of, let's get these boats that are working out there now, because we don't need them 3 years down the road. We need them right now.
Now, right.
And so it's also important to understand who your audience is, so that maybe you don't spend a ton of time working on something that's not going to be appreciated by that particular audience. That's a waste of time on your part. And time is as precious to us as it is to an audience. There's not a long enough lifetime to be able to get to all the magic you want to be able to do. So efficiency is important as well for a performer, so that they, and as I get older, I define more and more what groups I want to be working for and what I don't want to be doing, which is great, because it means that I don't need to buy as much as I used to. Most of the time now it's consumables or maybe mm-hmm. books. And I make a lot of my own things too that are tailored for what I want.
Also, having deadlines, I believe, is important, because that way, even if it's a self-imposed deadline, I'm going to have something finished by a certain date. As you get closer, you know, you got suddenly a fire to put out. The fire just becomes more and more
yeah.
raging at some point, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that stimulates some bit of creativity, because I've got to get this done by this date, but it's like, oh, I'm going to do this eventually. I'm going to write a book, you know.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I agree with that 100%. Now, I'm as guilty as perhaps the next person. Sometimes I'll procrastinate, or there in the creative process, there's no guarantees about any of those things. So sometimes it's an idea starts and I just realize it's not going in the direction I want it to. I either scrap it completely, or I set it on the back burner, and mm-hmm. and sometimes it will come back to me. I'll go, wait a minute, that's what I need now. I know how to finish that. I know where it needs to go. Some of the ones that didn't turn out to work out, components of those have ended up being the solution for a new problem. So I don't think it's ever lost, mm-hmm. as long as the attitude is such that won't be wasted. But there are times when things have come quickly to me because of a deadline, and I marvel, because I thought, oh, I never would have expected that would have come together so sweetly.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other times when the deadline happens and it's not what it needs to be, but
yeah.
it's good enough for now. And it's gonna evolve and develop. But had you not had the deadline, you might not have gotten to the point where it's even ready to
right.
further move
on. And throw
forward.
It out there and then start working on it.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just have a glob out there and you just start molding and whittling it away, going back to what we were saying then earlier too.
The street's been really interesting in that regard, because...
Good crucible.
Well, yeah, there's that. But I remember talking to Bill Malone. We went to Bob Fitch's workshops. I was there for quite a few times, and Malone was there. And he was doing Sam the Bellhop. And one of the things that he said, which was probably... pretty valuable for most of the working pros, is that the level of your performance and the quality of your performance is a material. And so to break in new material is a challenge, because you don't want to break it in front of paying customers, because mm-hmm. the caliber of that new piece isn't going to be, there's no way it can be as good as mm-hmm. your other A material.
Mm-hmm.
Out on the street, because people pay you after the fact, and if they don't like what you're doing, they can walk away.
Sure.
It's given me a nice freedom. It's removed a load off my shoulders about that worry about trying to make it perfect the first time. And so it enables the trick to evolve without the burden of wanting it or needing it to be perfect right off the top.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the tricks have become, from the street, have become great tricks in my regular show, simply because I had the luxury of not worrying about it working or not working.
Yeah. Well, speaking of time, thank you very much for yours. We spent a little bit of time over here. I know they're getting ready for the next event here shortly then, too.
It's been really nice, Scott.
Chris,
I've been really
you.
Happy talking about this. It's great.
You are just fascinating. I could spend another hour or longer.
Anytime. next year.
I should feature you, you know, for just one of our one-man podcasts sometime.
That'd be a lot
all
of
the
fun.
Kinds of things. So that's
I
great.
Would love
Chris,
to.
It's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks again. So that was Chris Pillsworth from Ottawa.
Ottawa, Canada.
Ottawa, Canada. That's not the other Ottawa.
Yeah, there are some right there.
It's right. For the Magic Word Podcast, this is Scotty out. All right, this is going to be a short one. We're into the elevator right now. Stephen Bragazza. Hey, Stephen.
Hey, how you doing, Scott?
Fine, thank
hey,
you. So, how are you getting along with your roommate, Rick Merrill?
Nobody gets along with Rick Merrill. I'm not even sure he likes me, but we're working on the show as we go. We went to lunch. That's the thing about 4F for us is that we don't ever get a break. And right after every show, we have to sit down and write at least 3 jokes that we might not use, and hopefully that we don't really hurt somebody.
Physically, you mean?
No. Well.
And this is going to be on the Saturday night show.
Yes. Yes, I hope so.
And you're going to be closing, or is that going to be...
Yeah. It'll be my 8th year of closing, other than last year being my own. But we just kind of recap. Everybody's seen all of my acts. We've seen what I do. So me and Rick, it was Steve Beam did it for years, and then I did it for 2 years by myself, and then now it's been me and Rick for the last 7 years.
Yeah. So how's it feel this year not being the center of attention?
Yeah, that part is great. I like that. You don't have to smile all the time and stuff. People don't stop you in the elevator and put microphones in front of you. None of that happens.
None of that happens this year.
No, it's been great.
All right. Well, the elevator has dinged. We finally reached the top floor. I'll talk to you more a little bit later.
Great, Scott.
Thank you, Stephen.
Hope
you
talk to me Saturday.
Okay. Yeah, after. You bet.
I want to talk to
him. Scotty out. Well, we just finished the first of the afternoon show over here on day 2 of the 4F convention, and in the dealer's room, here with Bob Little. Hey, Bob.
Yo, what is it? Bob Little. Wow.
And I've got Andy Dallas, too. Hey, Andy.
Hey, this is Andy Dallas. What's up?
And you are not actually a dealer here. You're just...
I'm just here as one of the attendees.
But you are one of the brick-and-mortar magic shop owners, and I did a podcast a while back with a few guys about the brick-and-mortar. And actually, your name had come up, Andy, as to costumes and how that kind of change. I was talking with Steve Lancaster in Tulsa, you know, about the costume shops and how that the Halloween costume business has changed a lot in magic shops in particular. Can you address that a little bit?
Want to know basically what the economics is of that?
No, not necessarily the economics. Just, okay. It's just that is the business not as much as what it was before? Are you having to sell more or less magic?
I mean, well, in every industry, like in Halloween, for example, is beginning to change.
Yeah,
and we're beginning to see. They're exploring what is going to be the next thing coming up.
Sure.
And it always happens in the years that, you know, Halloween goes from day to day over the years. And so in this next year it'll be Friday, the year after that it'll be Saturday, then the leap year, so we'll have Monday.
Right.
And those are usually the best days for Halloween.
Okay.
So we're beginning to see, we're hoping that that'll come back because we are seeing a slump in the overall industry.
Yeah.
But it's just a matter of time before, you know, it's done that before.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just have to kind of figure out how to reinvent yourself. And during that time, when you have that kind of going on, one of the neat things about the magic industry is that when people, you know, when there is a economic environment that isn't as good as it used to be,
mm-hmm.
they'll come back into the magic shops to get things because they're making their money,
yes,
extra money doing magic, and that's a really cool thing.
Yeah.
So we're seeing a lot more of that happen. In the brick-and-mortar magic shops, it's there's a whole lot more going on online now that are DVDs and what have you that are there. That
online downloads.
Right, that we can't really do like at the brick-and-mortar when you come in, you want to see something.
Sure.
And so we're really looking for those kinds of things that would sparkle up the magic shop, and we're just a tool shop basically.
Right.
Right.
Selling tools.
Yeah. I see when people come in, I go, hey, you know, we can stand here all day and look, but no magic's going to happen until you pick it up. So I'm the Home Depot of magic.
Do you have an online presence, and also you?
I have some, but it's not like I don't have a massive part of that, which doesn't mean that isn't going to come out of necessity. But right now, it's really good to get the magic people in, and we get to talk and show them different ideas that you're not going to get online.
Absolutely. The price, personal instruction. Well, Bob, I was going to ask you then, because I don't think you have much of an online presence. We don't sell anything online. Everything's pretty much brick and mortar for you.
Well, I never had a magic shop. I strictly sell through the conventions. I go to the magicians.
Yeah.
I never had a store in my life.
So you've been kind of an on-the-road shop, not an online shop, but on-the-road shop.
Yeah, kind of on the road.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you ever sell anything then? Are people come to your home, or, I mean, or is only at dealers?
No, it's quite old. We just got electricity about a month ago. No, I'm only joking on that. No, nobody would come to Hatboro, not for any reason. I mean,
except for the Super Sunday.
That's right. Yeah,
and that's going to be when this year, by the way?
It'll be June 8th. We got about 250 people, and it's a great one-day convention. How can you beat champagne, chocolate, and homemade cake? We throw in a little magic.
Yeah.
Hey, Scott, I've been to that and been a part of that, and that Super Sunday is a wonderful thing, and I'm very proud of his involvement in that.
And you do that like a couple times a year, too, don't you?
Yeah, twice a year, November and June.
Right.
Every year.
Right.
Yep.
And you never announce who the special guest is going to be?
No, we never announce who's going to be a star.
Yeah. But it's always somebody special.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, on Magic Shops, as far as the future of that, do you see ever selling this or passing this on to somebody else? And the same question to you, Andy, just thinking about that. I mean, is this something that someone has an interest, or has they ever approached you saying, hey, I want to buy you out?
Well, no, not really. Mike Miller will be taking over the business, and he'll be taking over the Super Sunday when I pass
on. Mike Miller will? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, my children have no interest in magic. They don't know what a thumb tip is.
Okay. Okay.
I spoke to Jay Marshall about this years ago.
Yeah.
And Jay Marshall said, the Magic Shop is a personality. You know, and if you remember, he had a lot of things that he published.
That's true.
And
yeah.
Because he was into that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So it was his.
Yeah, Magic Inc. had a lot of
right. And it was because of his personality in that magic community that made that happen. So
yes, that's true.
So you know, we all have these they're very personal. Brick and mortar stores are very personal and very cool.
Yeah.
And you go
very much customer related and customer service.
Well, and also, you know, that like I said, it takes up the personality of the person who either owns it or runs it.
Right.
And it's a very neat thing to it would be a shame to let them all go. I mean,
right.
this is just a wonderful place to come.
But is that something was just asking Bob. I mean, as far as someone who might be interested in taking yours over. I mean, when I was talking with Denny Haney, for an example, and Denny said, I don't have anybody to sell this to. When I'm gone, that's pretty much it.
That's the truth. I have my son who's really taking over the other part of the store.
Yeah, well, like Mark Stevens took over for Stevens Magic and
Pony. But my problem is Robbie, who appreciates variety entertainment because he's been brought up in it.
Yeah.
All right. Does not have any interest whatsoever in magic.
Yeah.
So it's like Bob's kids.
Yeah.
They have no interest. And so this is going to be a difficult decision for him to make as to whether to keep it or when he takes over my store,
right.
Whether to keep that department or not.
Right. Right.
So it's just one of those things you don't know where it's going to come from.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Well, Andy, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you very much. And again, about his Super Sunday.
Oh, yes.
You know, I performed there once. I was one of the people that was there, and I was the big guy, right?
Okay, yeah.
And it's just a wonderful event. So if people get a chance to hear this, be sure you check that out.
There you go. Super Sunday and a super endorsement, Andy.
Absolutely.
Allen. Thanks very much.
Scott, thank you.
Okay, for the magic word, this is Scotty out. Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and we just finished the afternoon show and soon going to be heading to dinner, but before we do, this afternoon we had a wonderful lecture by Tim Ellis. Hey there, Tim.
Hello.
Thanks for coming all the way from Australia. This is kind of a long way. Now, I was wondering, do you come by, do you go east to west or west to east? Where do you...
Well, this trip I came from L.A. to San Diego to Las Vegas to Denver to Florida to 4F.
Okay. I just wonder if you ever come from the opposite direction. Since it's
I've actually gone back one time. I booked a world trip when it was cheaper to go a world trip. So I went into L.A. and then I think we left from Denver and went the long way home.
Oh,
it was like about 30 or 40 hours or something.
A lot longer. Not going to do that again.
No.
Okay, I wondered. And so your lecture today, I thought was interesting CARE. And so explain what the acronym is again, that you're without having to go into the whole explanation of the lecture here.
It was CARE, how to make your audience care about what you do. So C for connect with the audience, A for alter your presentation, R for relate to your audience, and E for excellent magic.
And so I thought it was interesting, not only, of course, a lot of people want to see some tricks, and you have to, you know, they have the obligatory tricks you're going to be teaching in there, but I thought, you know, the information that you were talking about, it's important to have an emotion so people are going to have something that they can relate to and take home with them.
Absolutely, so, yeah.
And have you found that your magic has changed a lot, or even dramatically, let's say, over the last few years?
Yeah, I mean, I've always done comedy magic, and magic that has a sense of humor to it, a bit of fun to it, and I started changing things a little bit when I brought in the rings routine that I dedicate to my mentor Lindsay Reichel, and when I changed the presentation for that a few years ago, the audience reaction was very strong, because it was like, you know, oh yeah, very funny, ha ha ha. But at the end they actually were like, oh, you know, they wanted to come and talk to me about stuff, they wanted to talk to me about their mentor, they wanted to talk to me about experiences they'd had, and it was almost like I'd let them in on who I am. I'd open a little door. And I remember years ago, back in the 80s, my mentor at the time was a guy called Terry Danzig, who was a magician who was taking me around Australia on his big show that he was doing. And he always said, you don't want to be the boy next door. You want to be somebody that people say, I want that guy at my next dinner party.
No.
You know, they want to talk to you. They want to learn about who you are. And they don't,
it'd be interesting.
Yeah, you're not just a dancing monkey who entertains them and shows them a few special effects and that's the end of it.
You want to spend time with that person.
You want to know what makes them tick. And you look at all the celebrity magazines, they're not necessarily talking about the latest movie, but they're really interested in, you know, who are you seeing, what are you doing,
character
what are you wearing.
Driven.
Yeah, character driven, absolutely.
Yeah,
behind the scenes.
People want to know more about them and what, you know, why they get in trouble or, you know, whatever.
Well, you know, everyone knows when you do strolling magic, the questions people ask you are, you know, how did you get started in magic?
Sure.
What do you think of David Copperfield or David Blaine or
Whoever
Chris Angel?
It is the time.
Yeah, yeah. And they ask, you know, what's it like being a magician? They really want to know. And they don't want the story. They want the reality.
Yeah. And have you ever made up stories?
Occasionally. The one about the music box is mixed truth and fiction.
No, what I mean is make up stories. Like, after a while, do you ever find it kind of fun to play with people when they say, how did you get started magic?
I
once told somebody, I got started because that my father worked in Circus as a dealer, and my mother was a trapeze artist, and so she was the artist in the family, and my father was a card guy, and I, you know, it was the result of their night in Vegas. And so
people like say, a good story.
Yeah, they did. It was really, you know, it just all made sense, you know.
Yeah, I've got a friend who's made up his origin story, but you do get caught out occasionally when people are like, hang on a minute.
If you go too far.
But I satisfy my need for that by doing hoax presentations. I do. I get hired by companies to appear as a guest speaker. And, for example, I was hired to be the representative from Telstra and to do a speech on Telstra. There are telecommunications across Australia. And so I was explaining to people in the dinner party beforehand, I had to mingle with them as this character, and I was explaining to them that I was the one who was saving so much money for Telstra, because I realised after a survey that people would only stay on the line for 40 minutes for technical help, and then they'd hang up. So we designed the system so it would keep people on the line intentionally for long enough so they'd hang up, and that would save us a lot of money. And people were actually getting really angry with me.
Oh, really?
And by the time I got up to do my speech, I looked out and there were people like really frowning at me. They were really angry, and I was going, yes, this is what I want. I want them offside before I begin. It was great. Yeah.
And so what did you do to swing them towards your way?
I just spun the story further and further until slowly people started to go,
he's put this
on. This is not right. And then once I pulled a can of Coke out of my shoe, then all of a sudden they're like, okay, we've been done. And they really appreciated it. So it was nice. It was nice.
Yeah, I had once been introduced as being this particular type of an expert, and I said, well, for the first 30 minutes I want to talk about such and such and such, and the next 30 minutes talk about this, and then I'm going to wrap up the last portion of my speech, you know, talking about something else. And it was a boring kind of a thing, and I noticed two or three people actually got up and left the auditorium, you know, I mean, this banquet hall, you know. And the rest of them kind of had their hands on their cheek, you know. And I said, but before we begin, they say, you know, you should be open with a joke or something. I said, somebody taught me a trick, let me show you something. And it's like, oh, you like that? Maybe I can do something else like that. And then suddenly, you know, I'm sure the people went back to the bar and told those other people who had left, you know, what they missed.
I mean, I think the important thing is you make people talk about you. You know, they don't just talk about the trick, they talk about the experience, and they actually, you know, when you're watching a trick, as I said in the lecture, people are often watching it just to try and figure out how it's done.
Yeah.
Because that's all you're offering them. You're presenting a special effect. You're demonstrating the trick. But if you have a reason for doing it and you give them the reason, you explain to them why you're doing this and how important this is to you, and you show them passion. Mm-hmm. You know, like Steve Irwin, the crocodile hunter.
Right.
He was so passionate about what he did that he created a whole generation of, you know, wildlife warriors who just followed on from his passion that was infectious.
Yeah.
And I like to try and think that if I can share my passion, and to share, you have to open up. Mm-hmm. You've got to let people in. But you can't just stand there. Someone said that their favorite line for the lecture was, I said, back in the 80s, all the superheroes were two-dimensional superhero characters.
Makes perfect sense, yeah.
And that's just like magicians. That's what we're doing. We're being two-dimensional superheroes.
Yeah.
But now, since Batman Begins, everything's become much more three-dimensional. And you've got these complex characters who people can relate to. And they can say, yeah, you know, he may be Superman, but he still can't get Lois Lane. And he's got this love affair. And that's a bit like me and my girlfriend, you know. And,
yeah.
and people can connect.
Exactly. Yeah, when you were talking about, you know, standing out front of the theater, people are going to be going in to see David Copperfield. And he was telling his son, go ahead with that story.
Yeah, oh, it was actually The Illusionist in Sydney. But they're basically saying to his son, you know, all right, let's go and see how many tricks we can figure out.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the attitude they take. It's really, you know, I was explaining in the lecture that the suspension of disbelief that we often hear talked about in magic doesn't apply to magic. Mm-hmm. It's theatre. It's theatre. You go to theatre and you suspend your disbelief and pretend that the guy's Hamlet. You pretend that they're really on the shores in Scotland. You suspend your disbelief. But with magic, you watch it and you're going, ah, I bet that's strings. I bet that's this. Oh, no, it's not. Oh. And the magician is constantly disarming you.
Right.
And I think the best way to disarm the audience is by charming them and letting them in and letting them behind the veil. And Penn and Teller actually do that quite well. Penn and Teller, when you walk in, they seem to be exposing the magic. They seem to be treating you as adults.
Right.
They seem to accept. Yeah, they say, look, you're intelligent adults. Mm-hmm. We know there's no real magic, but watch this.
Yeah.
And it's delightful. Same with Derren Brown. You know, they treat you like an adult. But so many magic presentations are like, you know, I am the suit. And you go, we know you're not.
It's still a Doug Henning kind of a, whoo, wow, we.
Well, even Doug Henning, he had passion.
Sure.
And he had a childlike wonder, which opened up and unlocked that aspect of other people.
Right.
So, you know, that works. It worked for him. It doesn't work for anyone else.
Yeah.
It just worked beautifully for him.
Well, talk about drama. You had said earlier something about the aha moment, you know, something that was the eureka. Is this something that you have experienced in your
performance? Constantly. I mean, my new show that I'm working on for the Magic Festival this year is called One Defining Moment. And it's all about those moments in life where you suddenly go, that's what I'm here for.
Mm-hmm.
But when you look back on the moments you thought were that moment, sometimes you go, okay, at the time I thought that was it, but now I realize that was not it. You know, maybe you fell in love, maybe you suddenly discovered magic, maybe you won an award, and those were the moments you thought, that's it now. And then further down the track, you go, oh, it wasn't that after all. You know, you hear lots of humanitarian stories where people have made millions of dollars in their computer programming life, and suddenly they go to Africa and they realize they should be there digging up wells.
Yeah.
That's what they're there for.
Right.
So people have these moments all the time, but the question is, what is the one defining moment where you suddenly realize that's it? And so my show examines that. And for me, it really has been that legacy, the fact that I've stood on the shoulders of the people who've come before and taken tricks that they've developed and taken them a step further. And I expect the stuff that I've developed to be taken by the next generation and developed a step further.
Mm-hmm.
But by doing that, you become part of the pastiche, part of the whole culture of magic, part of the history of magic. And that sort of is one way to live forever, in a way. I know that Lindsay, who people would never have heard of before, is people are remembering him now, even though they never met him, through the Linking Ring routine. And for me, it's an honor to pass that tribute on.
And I love that line that you had said about it would take a lifetime to learn and a second lifetime to perfect, to become a master.
Yeah. With the rings, yes. It takes a lifetime to learn and two lifetimes to master.
Yeah. And
it's always a work in progress. I think magic is constantly a work in progress.
And, well, you have put out the... the rap song, or the rap, what is that again?
Six card rap,
that's right. Yeah. And did you feel like was that a point where, okay, I'm going to let that go and that I'm going to work on something else and that's perfect as it possibly can be?
No. The situation with the rap was I've been doing the rap since 1991. Mm-hmm. And I figured, you know, once I turn 50, for goodness sake, I'm a 50-year-old guy doing the rap. This is crazy.
Yeah.
And I said that I'll stop doing the rap then. But I still had requests. I do a lot of shows in Asia at magic conventions and events over there, and they kept saying, you got to do the rap. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, well, as a compromise, I'll put it on the market. So I put it on the market, and Hocus Pocus have it exclusively.
Right.
And so you get the book, the DVD, the CD-ROM, or the CD with the music on it. They've thrown in a hat and sunglasses and a thing around your neck and all this sort of stuff, and the rights to perform it.
Yeah.
So there's a very limited edition of that. But I haven't stopped doing it, but basically I'm letting the other people, because I've had so many people contact me, oh, can I get the music for the rap? I go, no, you can't do it. Oh, but no, that's not available.
Yeah.
And now it's like, okay, go ahead,
Here it is.
But I'm not ditching it, and it's not stopping me, you know, by pushing it aside. It doesn't mean now I can work on other things. I'm constantly working on other things.
I was just talking with Chris Pillsworth from Canada a little bit earlier this afternoon, and he was talking about, he was the one who did the cactus, well, you didn't see him last year, but a cactus inside of a balloon, and he's going to be doing this turban thing tomorrow night.
Yeah.
But the point is that he said that as we grow, there are certain things we let go of. I mean, we introduce babies into our act, but, you know, our grandfathers, the things that are in our act are our A act. Mm. But at some point, as you evolve, perfect example, then with the rap that you were talking about, that it's, okay, this is no longer for me, this is for a younger person, perhaps, and I'm going to be having some other things like these beautiful rings that you're doing or something, you know, that you do age-appropriate types of
exactly.
effects.
Age-appropriate is the word, and I've seen a lot of people, like I saw some magicians recently performing, and they were doing their material that I've seen them do on VHS back in the 80s, and it hadn't changed. And I was looking at it, and I was going, you know, you guys should have progressed by now. You know, it's what's happened. Did you just go, we've perfected it and that's it, because it's not no longer perfect?
I see it as Maslow's hierarchy of need. There are certain things along the way, and it's, you know, you are you're satisfied at certain levels. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that you have to keep going to the pinnacle, of that hierarchy, because not everybody reaches that point of, you know, self-esteem.
Mm.
But you may be satisfied at some level of happiness, you know, with security or wherever that you're going to be. And the same thing within your growth in magic, you know, that some people, you know, like close-up, or they like stage or escapes or mentalism or children's magic or whatever it happens to be. And there's nothing wrong with any phase you are, but just know where you are and where others are necessarily, and I don't think you have to aspire to be a Tim Ellis, but you can look at, well, it was a great line. Was it you or someone else? Someone had said, Oscar Wilde had said,
be yourself because everybody else is taken.
That's great. That's true. But you may not know who you are for yourself. There would have to be those aha moments, those times of self-discovery, and then continue to grow on that. You can't say, okay, I have discovered myself and I am not going to be anybody more than what I am. Yes, you can be, but you can still massage those things to be somebody.
A lot of the stuff that I'm doing now, a lot of the sort of stuff that I did in the show In Dreams, is stuff that I could never have done 10 years ago because it just was an ill-fitting suit. But now I've grown into it.
Yeah.
With age and experience, you start to go, all right, okay. And you can sell it better because it comes from your heart. It comes from within you. And with the show In Dreams, it was for the Melbourne Magic Festival last year, and the segment with the colouring book and the torn restored photo, they were from that show. And the show was my vanity project. I basically said, you know, I feel I want to do this show. It's just something within me. I want to do the show, and I don't care if anyone comes or not. And the first show was good, and the next three shows were sold out because obviously people seemed to talk about it. They liked it, and I was thrilled about it. And it was also important for the other performers of the festival to see you can do what you want to do, not what you think the audience wants to see.
Right.
And I think that's really a good definition of art. You know, if you're going to be turning around and saying, okay, the audience loves the floating table, I've seen other performers do it, so I'm going to do the floating table, that's more like a craft.
Yeah.
You know, than an art. If you turn around and go, you know, I've got this idea of a table that will float, and you come up with your own presentation, your own method, your own, that's art. You know? But just copying everyone else is like a cover band, and we've got enough cover bands.
you've answered my next question. That was going to be to define the difference between art and craft. I think you just did, you know, because I hear those almost used interchangeably, you know, as magic is an art or magic is a craft.
Well,
you know,
when I did my show at the festival, we have a big battle with the arts bodies in Australia because they won't describe magic as an art because they see it as basically a self-funding popular entertainment. And we had some people in the Arts Centre come along and they saw my show and they were actually saying, you know, this is what we want.
This is the drama and everything.
Well, it was a combining magic and theatre. Mm-hmm. And people often get confused. They think, you know, oh, it's just about telling a story. And you'll see some people, they'll tell a story, they'll do a trick. They'll tell a story, they'll do a trick. And it's like the old days when in the 80s when they did stand-up comedy magic where you'd tell a joke, do a trick, tell a joke, do a trick. And the tricks and the jokes had nothing to do with each other. And everyone's like, hey, I'm a stand-up comedy magician. It's like, well, not really. He's just doing a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
But with a lot of bizarre magic and some of the McBride students, they tend to sort of do a story and a trick, and they sort of relate them in a bit of an obscure philosophical way, and it comes across more like a lecture than anything else. But the hardest thing is actually to combine them. And I just saw Teller's presentation of The Tempest. That was a combination where he had seamlessly blended the magic into the show, because the main character is played as a magician, and all of the tricks are relevant. They are tricks that, like, when one of the spirits just produces a crown and then teases the guy with it by having the crown float and hover above his head, and then it goes back and then it's around and the guy's reaching for it and he can't see the spirit, but the spirit's actually causing the crown to float.
Right.
So the audience gets the joy of the magic, and yet it really progresses the story.
It moves the story along.
And it's really hard to find that right balance, because often you see in some of the Disney musicals, they'll insert a magic effect and it really jars the story, or the audience misses the trick. That's why I did the ambitious card routine in the show, in the lecture. I call it a show. Yeah. In the lecture, because the magic is in there. And each time a piece of magic happens, I comment about it and I talk about why it's so important to have that reaction and how it moved me as a person. And as the audience, they enjoy the story, but it actually expands their enjoyment of the magic. And instead of being a standard ambitious card, there's the card, goes in, there's the top, they're like, wow, how did that happen? And then as progressively gets more complicated, you know, in the deck, and then it's suddenly in my fingers, and then finally in the music box, it's quite a strong effect magic-wise, as well as being emotionally strong. So I quite enjoy playing with those things, those multi-level presentations.
So perhaps, and you had talked about this specifically, about the David Copperfield flying versus Peter Pan flying. You know when you go to the play that Peter Pan is obviously on some strings, but when you go and see Copperfield, there has to be some strings, but I can't see it, so you're thinking about the method.
Yeah.
Perhaps if they were to use the method in context of something, okay, to get from one side of the stage, I'm just going to float over there, you know, that's like, wow, how'd that happen? They're not necessarily going to be thinking about that.
You mean in the play or in
the... No, I'm talking about if Copperfield did not make the trick.
Yeah.
You know, in other words, that if his whole thing was not just flying, if he was actually in the context of going to do something else.
Well, that's the hard thing, because I've done a few things like that in my shows. I did one in Dreams where that started with a guy carrying on a cardboard box and put it down there, and then a few minutes later I got out of the box.
Yeah.
And it didn't register to people. They didn't go, oh, wow, you know, empty box, and this person appeared. They just watched it and went, all right. And I'm sure in the back of their mind, they were going,
wait a minute,
that's odd.
Yeah.
And that was the effect that I wanted. But you've got to figure out...
Rather than focusing on the method. Well, how did
I didn't want them to go,
gasp. Yeah. So
I wanted it to be a gentle
thing. Sure.
Yeah. So you've got to consciously decide on what you want. If you just want to have people go, he just flew. But of course he can fly, he's Copperfield.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I remember in Siegfried and Roy's show, there's this lovely moment where they would do the elephant vanish,
right?
And then someone would yell out from the audience. It was all set up. They'd yell out,
right,
you know, how do you change your clothes? And they go, oh, we just make a 10-ton elephant disappear, and he wants to know how I change your clothes. And that's purely so the audience, who have been totally blasted by all these effects, goes, yeah, they did.
Yeah.
And they get another round of applause.
See the subtlety.
Yeah. And it's like they thought through so carefully. They're like, okay, we're not getting a strong enough round of applause for that trick. We need to remind the audience what they just saw.
Yeah.
And it works. Uh-huh. And a lot of the time you have to say, okay, I need to give the audience moments to applaud. It's like the rings. When I do the rings, some audiences will clap every link. And I actually don't like that because it breaks up the whole flow of it.
Sure, sure.
And then other times when I deliberately don't give them any chance to applaud, and throughout the routine I don't give them a chance, but just, you know, some people start and other people follow.
Yeah.
But when nobody applauds till the end, it's much more satisfying because that's how I want it to come across. It's like in a play, you know, somebody does Macbeth and he does a really good reading of Macbeth. People don't just jump up and go, oh, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
They're in the moment, in the story. And in Teller's show, in The Tempest, because a lot of times there were tricks and the audience really wanted to clap the tricks, they'd go to blackout between scenes and the audience would clap. So they give them that breathing space.
Makes sense. Let me ask you something in a completely different direction. That is, next year's FISM is going to be in Rimini, Italy.
In Italy.
Have they had it in Italy in a while? I think, I don't remember.
Not for a while.
In some decades of it being there necessarily. Have you, now you're involved with FISM as a judge?
I've been a judge in the past. I haven't been a judge. I wasn't a judge at Blackpool.
Yeah,
that was the first FISM I didn't go to.
But in others that you have been, and a FISM winner, of course. And I'm just wondering if you have any ideas or thoughts about how you think that this convention will be. And
I don't know. I've heard that they do a really good Masters of Magic every year, and the organizers are very organized.
Nice festival,
So I'm interested in finding out how it's going to go.
Yeah.
It runs the same in the second week as our Melbourne Magic Festival. We run our festival in June 30th to July 12th.
Mm-hmm.
And FISM's in the second week of our festival, so
you're not sure
I've got to decide. Yeah, I know. I'm actually thinking, because there'll be so many magicians from Australia going.
Right.
I'm thinking we might just do a one-week festival next year. I don't know. We've got to figure out what we're going to do. So I'm hoping to go there.
Right.
I always find it hard to go to a FISM or a festival or a convention if I'm not performing. I get very restless.
I want to be up there.
Yeah, I've got to be up there. Like you know, that's where I feel most at home.
Sure.
I feel very, very comfortable on stage. Off stage, I'm a terrible audience member. I'll sit there watching it. That's why I'm good as a judge, because I judge the acts anyway. I don't mean to. It's just
your nature.
Yeah, it's just looking at it going, oh, if you tried that, that'd be better. Or, oh, that didn't work, you know.
Yeah.
It's just...
Well, you have good write-ups also, you know, things, because you do give your comments. It seems like that those are your streaming consciousness. Those are your thoughts as you're, you know.
I've got this great idea that we wanted to do for Korea. And if anyone from the FISM Italy committee is listening to this, maybe they'll take this idea. We wanted to somehow do a way of broadcasting the competition so people can subscribe to it and watch it on the internet. So they could watch all of the acts and then also have... for each country, a local commentary team.
Okay.
So it was like the Olympics.
Uh-huh.
So
it'd
be like, okay, this next act, they competed in 1994 and they did quite well. They did an act, what are they going to do this year? Let's have a look. Here they go. Oh, we're about to start. Here we go. You know.
That'd be fun.
And then afterwards, bring an expert commentator, just, you know, oh, this is, he's in Illusions. What did you think of that? Oh, it's good. You know.
Yeah.
And I think it just really would add to the whole thing and
make it much
more exciting.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Huh. That may be an idea that's ahead of its time, but I think
it's been an idea I've had for a couple of FISMs far, but now we've got the internet, we can do it.
Well, that's true, but I'm saying that they're still developing internet as far as some of the streaming of things and how they're going to password protect and, you know, who's going to be doing it. I think that has some good merit.
Absolutely.
Well, as we start to wrap up then, because I know people are going to be heading out to dinner here shortly, and that is the name of my podcast. It's called The Magic Word. So my question to you of what your magic word would be. Not necessarily something that you would... say on stage, could be a life chi. You know, what is your philosophy? You know, what do you live by? What's important to you? You know, it could be a word or a phrase or a whole paragraph or a whole lecture.
I guess it'd be passion.
Passion.
Passion. I think you have to have the passion for what you're doing, because if you don't, there's no point in doing it. Absolutely no point.
Yeah.
If you're just walking through the motions, find something else to do, really, because...
it's not for you.
Yeah, I think, why waste your life? You only get one shot. So why waste your life doing something you don't enjoy? I've got friends who are doing jobs. You know, they're doing their 9-to-5 jobs because they have to pay the bills, and I can understand that. But you've still got time in your hobby, in your spare time, to find something that you're really passionate about, that really, you know, gives you that one defining moment where you go, I know why I'm here. This is what I'm destined to do. It may not be performance. It might be washing the car. Or I don't know. You might be passionate about making cars shine better than they've ever shone before.
That's great too. Whatever it is for you.
I love in Korea, everyone is so passionate. Whatever their job is given, whatever they're you know, the guys who hold the arrows on the side of freeways, and they send, in Korea, they spin them around, they toss them out, and they have championships.
No kidding.
They have, I saw on TV, it was a televised championship, and guys are tossing the signs, they're balancing, they're juggling, tossing around. And I was going, these guys are so passionate about holding a sign up to get people to drive past. And I thought, you know, if magicians had that same passion, you wouldn't be seeing people falling asleep during magic shows. You know?
Exactly. Good. And, Tim, thanks very much. I appreciate your time. I thank you for everything that you do for magic and in magic as you're a very talented magician. And I'm glad to be a friend of yours, too. Thanks very much for being on the Magic Word podcast. That was Tim Ellis. And for the Magic Word, this is Scotty out. Well, it's Thursday night, Magic and Martini night, and we are on our way actually over to Alex's. And when I say we're on our way over, I mean we're literally walking our way over. So it's only about a block or so, but we have to walk in heavy traffic. But that's okay. I'm going to put Jeff Williams on my left. So speaking of which, hey, Jeff.
Hey, Scott. How are you doing?
Good. I'm going to get on the side.
Ah, okay. Yeah, we just switched.
As I said.
For those of you with stereo, I'm now on the other speaker.
So are you going to be on tomorrow night, or when you're doing Saturday night?
Yeah, and actually I'm closing the Saturday 3:30 show.
Okay, so people are still awake that time.
I hope I hope so.
So how have you enjoyed the convention so far?
I'm loving it. This is, I think David Corsaro, as Di Vernon said it perfectly, it's not just a magic convention. This is a family. You know, we're kind of a large, distended, sometimes non-functional family, and it's fantastic.
That's true. And I thought that was, you know, a very funny routine that he had done, obviously on that. I tell you, the highlight for me so far, and you got to agree with me, is going to be Michael Dardant acting as Sean Farquhar, the guest of honor.
Yes, in fact, I was talking with Raj Madoc, who a lot of your listeners might know. He's one of the underground guys from Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. And he said he had closed his eyes for just a little bit, and when he sort of came to, he was listening, and he thought, well, what is Sean doing up there already? And then he looked up, and he was disoriented because there was Michael Dardant, but he's had his hair spiked up in the outfit. But the voice was perfect,
spot on, and his gestures and everything, you know, thumbs up and everything, and his asides, and he kept in character the whole time.
Yeah, I think he would have fooled Lori and Hannah as well. But he did that well.
Yeah, and even whenever he had Sean come up and stand beside him, Sean was wiping tears from his eyes, and he was mimicking him like he were in a mirror, you know.
Oh, exactly. It was literally, it's the highlight of the convention, and I'm not expecting anything to top that soon.
So you're not going to be eating glass light bulbs this time or anything?
Not this time around, no.
That was kind of a one-time thing, I guess.
Well, yeah, probably. I don't like to do that too often.
Yeah. So anything that... we got cars passing us. I told you, we're walking on the street over here. There is no sidewalk. But I can see in the distance. It's right near Batavia Downs. I guess the races are closed during this time of the year. I've never been to a race over there.
Yeah, I don't think so. They have a casino there, so that's open.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, it's open 8 a.m. to 4 a.m.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's unusual. I guess they got to hose the place down or something.
If any of our group goes there, that's for sure.
So is it a real casino or is it just slot machines or, you know?
I don't know. I don't know.
So as far as other conventions or whatever what have you been doing so far here this year?
Well, last month I was at the Winter Carnival of Magic in Pigeon Forge and had a blast there.
Yeah.
Really. That was a fantastic time. So our listeners need to put that one on their radar and visit it because it was a gorgeous place, great theater.
Really, good time of year.
Oh, yeah, it was perfect. I mean, it was, the weather was very, very nice. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, loved it.
And did you go to the Magi Fest in Columbus?
No, I wasn't able to go. I was busy.
Yep, same here. I missed that. I think you and I missed a good one there. Yep. Like, are you coming to the joint convention?
Unfortunately, no. I've got a bunch of fundraisers that I'm doing. I'm doing a lot of fundraising with my show with churches and schools, and so unfortunately that's keeping me a little bit too busy to be able to go off and do that.
You know, I heard a lecturer, David McGee, was talking about doing fundraisers and the importance of doing them. Not only, of course, you're doing something good, but it puts you in front of the right people. You know, they always, if you choose your fundraisers properly, in other words, it's not just for the local PTA, but if you're doing something on a more national, international scope, where the people are, you know, giving tens of thousands of dollars instead of tens of dollars, you know, you have access to a potentially, you know, more well-heeled audiences who might hire you for something else. Do you ever work on those kinds of high-end fundraisers?
Yeah, for the most part, I've done some stuff with Raymond James, which is a financial group.
Sure. I've done several things with them myself.
Yeah, and
they have money.
I've worked with them and Chichi Rodriguez group down in Florida as well. But for the most part, I think my heart is really at helping the smaller groups, the ones that have basically, say, seating for 1,000 or less. Mm-hmm. Anything from 200 up to 1,000. There are quite a few groups that fit that demographic, and that's been my focus right now, and they've been very receptive, and it's really keeping me busy.
Have you thought about going overseas and doing lectures or performing over there?
Oh, I'd love to. I was in England for about 3.5 weeks this past September, and
I think I remember seeing some pictures on Facebook that you had posted.
Yeah, a lot of fun. I stayed with Martin Cox over there.
Yeah,
great guy.
In Bath?
He's in Bishop Stortford, but we got to go all over, which was really, really nice. And so I look to, I've been in Europe a couple of times with lecture tours. Pascal Marc from France, brilliant guy who's wonderful for putting together a variety of tours and things. And so I look forward to doing that one again. But for the most part, I really love waking up in my own bed, not living out of a suitcase. I mean, traveling is great, and having, you know, shows and lectures and faraway places is really awesome. But boy, there's nothing like having a meal in your own kitchen.
Yeah.
You know, I just love it. And I love Florida. It's sort
I was about
of
to say, you've been in Florida now for what, how many years?
3.5.
Yeah.
Yeah, moved down there, got married, and
wonderful lady. Looks a lot like my wife. Looks like Kathy. I always thought they were twins.
Oh, they hit it off together when we were together.
Yeah.
So fantastic. I absolutely. Hey, bring my. That's mine. Okay. I'll get another deck of cards. They hit it off real well. I love travel, but by golly, I live in paradise. And I love it down there, and the more I can do down there, the better.
Yep. Well, great. Thanks a lot, Jeff. And so we're about to enjoy dinner. We're going to sit here at Alex's place. We just pulled in. So it's Magic and Martini Thursday night, and I'm glad that you're joining us.
Thank you very much.
This is one of those cool things I kind of put on Facebook saying, hey, I got reservations for Thursday's Magic and Martini night, and Jeff's one of the first guys that popped up. So,
well, thanks, guys.
Thank you, buddy.
I really appreciate this service that you're doing to magicians all over who maybe can't be here but can live vicariously through you.
Thank you very much. That was Jeff Williams for the Magic Word Podcast. Scotty out. All right, well, we've finished our dinner, and we've had the Thursday night Magic and Martinis night and over at Alex's, and came back, and we saw then the wonderful lecture by the guest of honor, Sean Farquhar. But I've got with me right now Vinnie Grasso, past international president of the Society of American Magicians, and also author of the book...
Exposed and Fearless.
I started to say Fearless and Exposed. I had them reversed over there. Exactly. Good to see you here.
Good to see you, Scott.
I enjoyed your performance this afternoon. Well, it's a different kind of a take you did with the blindfold using transparent tape over the eyeballs. That's kind of a cool idea.
I wanted to do a blindfold that, because you're performing for a bunch of magicians, that people would know that you're really blindfolded.
Sure.
And I was just going to have someone keep their fingers in my eyes, and I was over at Target getting supplies for other stuff, and Andy Dowd, I ran into him in the supply section of Target.
He's looking for his sack, too.
And he said it's something that James, he approached with the Occult Investigation Committee, needing to test someone that wanted to use their blindfold, and he approached James Randi about it, and Randi said your eyelids are the weakest
muscle in your body,
and you tape your eyelids shut.
Yeah.
And so Andy told, it was this morning that I that Andy told me that, and that's why he said
that all the time, and it shows
well,
his blindfold.
Sure. I think he knows Randi, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think he's heard the name. So what made you think of then the tape?
Andy told me to.
So he said to use the tape.
Yeah.
Oh,
and,
I see. Okay.
And,
okay.
And I got the wrong tape at first, and then he's like, "No, that's not clear. You got to go get the clear set.
Right.
The regular invisible tape is not
the
clear.
Magic tape.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So. Magic tape. He used magic tape.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. I wanted to talk with you about your Exposed and Fearless book.
Yeah, we said we would follow up after the Kickstarter.
Yes,
I
wanted to ask you a few questions about the Kickstarter. What did you find? A lot of people have been using Kickstarter, certainly as magicians who have new playing cards that are out and whatever.
Yeah.
Sometimes they make the money, sometimes they don't. As a follow-up, how much did you ask for and how much did you get?
I asked for $9,000 and I got a little over 12.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you had to make at least the 9,000 before that they'd even pay out, otherwise.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And so with the 12, then as far as Kickstarter, then you had to pay them something for that, or
how
does that work out?
Yes, they get a percentage, and also just because the way the whole thing with Kickstarter works is that you have to have an Amazon account, and when you make the pledge, you're committing your Amazon account, but nothing's been charged at that point, and it's not until after that time period. So a lot of people, either credit cards expire or things happen. So it's not just that you get the money that Kickstarter takes out of it.
Right.
You also have Amazon taking their percentage for the credit card fees, and then you also end up with people that the card information has changed and they don't go through. So it roughly comes out to, you definitely lose a minimum of 10%.
Okay.
Between Kickstarter fee and Amazon fee and some of the losses.
So if you're planning on doing a Kickstarter thing, you should probably plan on asking for 10% more than what you really need?
Yeah, 10 to 15 to...
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
And so, okay, so then you got the money. And so then what were you going to do then from there? You had the book or the project. What happened from there?
From there, I procrastinated. That's the bad thing. I factored in plenty of time for me to do the book and get the show done, and I had a specific date for the show, and that actually ended up being my main motivator. I mean, I had this idea that I'll put this out 6 months, but maybe I'll get the book done a lot early and surprise my backers and do that, and that didn't happen.
Okay.
I scrambled to get it done in time, but I did hit the date. The show was there. The books were there for the show. Gave them out. Now I'm shipping out books to all the other backers that weren't at the actual show.
Right.
So,
how many copies did you actually print?
I didn't print that many because it's also it was a self published deal.
Yeah.
And I am now working with an editor to really revamp the book for the next go around and go to a publishing house for it. So the whole purpose, I think we talked about this earlier, if I went to a publisher in the very beginning, it was going to be about a 2-year process to, 1 to 2 year process before it would get out. And I got this out obviously a heck of a lot quicker. And now I'm going to start that other process because I think I've been getting good enough feedback from the book that it's worth doing this. If the feedback was, hey, it's good and all that, maybe I would just go and put it up on Amazon at this point and not do it.
And for those who have not necessarily listened to that podcast and don't know about the book, would you just briefly explain what this is about and the stories of the people who have contributed?
Sure. The book is... The name of it is Exposed and Fearless, and it's about people that I've either worked with as a tour manager. I've tour managed several acts.
Not magicians necessarily. You talk about comedians and
correct. Actors. Correct. Yeah. Well, yeah. One of the first chapters on Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer, and I talk about him and the way he whispers to dogs, but it's how he communicates using energy and his understanding of the interaction between animals, counting us humans as animals.
Right. Yeah.
And then there's a whole host of people in the magic community that I've known and worked with, but I've focused on people that do some real amazing things, not necessarily tricks. And that's been the whole angle of the book and the show, is that these are real things that are happening, and they're amazing. And then also the whole fear aspect of it, and all of these people have fear is certainly an element with all of these folks, but it works in different ways with a lot of them, and exploring how some use it as motivation, others use it as
keeping their edge, perhaps.
Yes, yeah. It's been a really fun process. If I wasn't having to write so much of it so quick, I was really enjoying the process. I'm going to enjoy going deeper. Like as I was working with a person to clean the book up, his comments were, it'll be great to revise this again, and then also dig deeper on some of these interviews as kind of the central theme is becomes more prevalent. Because with any project, whether it's a show that we're working on, a routine that we're working on, or a book, when you start it, the idea that you have versus when you're working in it, it changes and it matures.
So if people want to purchase the book, obviously it's no longer available. It's just for those who were in the Kickstarter part, but you were going to be publishing another one. Are you going to do another Kickstarter?
I have some books that I kept some, I overprinted what I needed to deliver by some, and I have them available. I'm on my website, exposedandfearless.com. It's completely out of date. It was when I was still promoting the show. But there's a little form that you can fill out to get information about the book. And when they come in, I send out basically like a hidden webpage. So it's not anything that I'm overtly publicizing, but you can purchase the book.
So if people want to do that, how would they contact you or find
out? Yeah, exposedandfearless.com is the website for it. Or they can find me on Facebook or...
Vinny Grasso. And so would you spell that also?
Vinny is V-I-N-N-Y, and Grasso is G-R-O-S-S-O.
Right.
So, yeah.
And so we find you on Facebook or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we're all connected to, a gazillion magicians anyway, so.
That's true.
Yeah.
Well, good. Congratulations. Yeah. Glad that it all worked out then.
Thanks,
for you.
I appreciate it. And I appreciate you giving the coverage in the beginning. It was great.
Thank you for being a friend of the magic word, too.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Great.
Appreciate that.
Thanks, Scott.
Okay, thanks again. That's Vinny Grasso for the magic word. Scotty out. All right, well, I'm heading to the elevator now. We just finished talking with Vinny Grasso, and as we were in the elevator earlier, you might remember the conversation earlier today with Steve Brigazzi, and I was asking him a question about his roommate. Well, now I've got his roommate with me. Hey, Rick. Rick Merrill, sorry.
How are you? Good. How are you, Scott?
Fine, thank you. So, what's it like? Yeah, going up to the donut room. It's time for some donuts.
That's right.
So, what's it like rooming with the big guy, Steven?
Well, I'm just going to take a guess, and he'll say that I snore. But the reality is he snores more than anyone I've ever heard, and it makes it difficult to sleep. But
so I don't recommend necessarily rooming with him.
Yes, do not room with Steve unless you are, you don't care about sleep or hygiene or any of that stuff. But it's great fun. We have to come up with an act. By
Saturday night,
right,
yeah.
Right.
And you don't have anything. You got some preconceived notion coming in.
Yes, but that's already blown to heck because of some of the things that have transpired. So, is it two?
Three.
Three.
Yeah.
So, the best part about rooming with him is the 2 a.m, we're sitting there trying to write lines and come up with things, and everything's hilarious at 2 a.m.
I'm sure everything's funny. It's kind of like in the middle of the night, you have a dream. It's like, it's a great idea. You write it down the next morning. Right. So what the heck is this?
And that's what we do, right? So we're just dying, tears and coming down our face when we're writing in the middle of the night. And then in the morning, we relook at everything, and it's not quite as good. And we're back to square one. So,
well, let me ask you about FISM next year at Rimini, Italy. Are you planning on going, attending?
Yeah, I am. I'm planning on it. I missed. I was in Beijing, and I missed Blackpool, which sounds like that was the one to miss.
I think we've gone too far. Wait a minute.
It's supposed 200. To be Scott, come on.
Is it 200?
It's got to be.
Okay, well, we'll go back down.
This is a ploy to get a longer interview, ladies and gentlemen.
So yes, you're going in.
So what? Yeah, I'm planning on it. And hey, guys.
Hey, Eric.
And it should be a good time, and it's about time it's back in Europe proper.
Yeah. Yeah.
You going?
Yes, I am planning on it.
That'd be awesome.
I'm hoping to maybe extend my stay a little bit longer, go up to Tuscany, maybe rent a villa or something with a few folks, and spend some time in the wine region and hang out. So
I was there once. My wife and I went to Venice, and it was unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Unbelievable. So
Were you lecturing back then?
Yeah, I did a convention. I don't remember what it was, but I did a convention and a, mm-hmm. a show and a lecture, and then we took some time and, you know, took a gondola ride in mm-hmm. Venice, me, my wife, and Danny Cole.
He was a third wheel.
That's kind right.
of. Okay.
But we got some great photos out of it.
Let's try two this time. Okay, here we go. You got some great, well, I haven't been to Venice since 1972. And I guess it's sinking even worse. I guess
it's sinking. Yeah.
So I want to go see. My wife has never seen it, so I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Pigeons are bad.
Is that what you'd recommend? Staying away from those. And the pickpockets, I heard, are pretty bad
yes,
too.
Yes. Yes.
Well. So all right. Well, that's next year, and you're just going to go as a voyeur, spectator, aren't you?
That is correct. You know what? We're not getting a donut.
There's no, that's not open either. Okay. Maybe it was 10:30. Maybe it's not till later. All righty. Well. I'm going to go up to my room.
That's right. Well, yeah. I'm going to go.
We'll have donuts here shortly. What time is it anyway?
Find a candy bar. I have no idea.
Okay. Well, maybe we're just early. I don't know why that room isn't open. Yeah, that's the deal. Okay.
Right.
Well, very well. Thank you
yes,
very much.
No problem.
Good talking to you, Rick.
You too.
Good luck.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to, what is it, Thursday? So it's a couple nights from now.
You still got plenty of time.
You still got time to be creative.
That's right. Hopefully.
And have some more ideas
yes.
coming. You know, this has been the longest elevator ride I've ever had by myself or with anybody.
Pray for us. We need to come up with an act soon.
And this is only a 5-story building. I think we haven't
That's
checked
right.
out one of the floors at least.
That's right.
So far. All right. Anyhow, Rick, thanks very much for your time.
No problem.
I'm get off here
My
eventually.
Pleasure.
I'll talk to you later. Good luck.
Bye.
That's Rick Merrill for the Magic Word. Scotty out.
Bye.